Hello there.
Ask any questions you have.
In your opinion, what is the relationship between like your whole life and the way to this life to the way of all that people here? What is the relationship between the publicity about auto safety and the recent cutbacks in production and auto sales?
Well, I believe that the cutbacks are primarily an attempt to get their inventories in proper balance. I think the industry has been producing at a rate greater than their sales, and their inventories have become rather excessive. And I think that that's primarily the reason for the cutbacks, although I think that the hearings in Washington with respect to safety of the cars has had some small impact upon the attitude of the American consumers. And I would hope that the industry would now begin to apply to the question of how can we build safer cars, the kind of ingenuity and the kind of initiative which they have also in the past given to the question of design.
Mr. Ruther, some people think
let us finish this then. No, I wouldn't think so. I think that if the industry did that, they would be missing the point. I hope that the industry has learned a great deal out of these hearings and will respond affirmatively and constructively, as I think they will. And I hope that the American people will have learned something out of these hearings, because only as the industry and the public cooperate can we make our highways more safe.
Mr. Ruther, some people think that as a result of the hearings, the finger might be pointed in the direction of labor as to part of the problem in auto safety. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, I believe that all our people do is they put the cars together. They don't determine their basic character or their design. And we have been saying for a long time that we believe we do need more careful safety inspection in terms of the assembly of the cars. And if you will read the testimony that we presented to the Congress, you will find that we made the question of a more effective system of inspection one of the items that we recommended.
Mr. Ruther, earlier this week here on the West Coast, one of your vice presidents, Mr. Woodcock, said that in his opinion, the safety hearings in Washington had probably very little, if anything, to do with the current slump and cutback in the car market. Are you two at variance?
No, I just said a minute ago that I believe that the cutback in the cars is essentially an attempt to adjust the levels of inventories, which became excessive, and that the impact of the safety hearings was rather small, although I don't think you can ignore it completely, although it's relatively small.
Mr. Ruther, are you ever, in the foreseeable future, going to attempt to gain control over the investment of your union's pension funds?
Well, we are not as much concerned with the control of those funds as we are with their social use. And if we can get the kind of use of these funds in terms of community projects, housing, community facilities, and the other kinds of things that we think they should be used for, then we would be quite prepared not to make an effort to get control so long as the social use of these funds met our standards. Well, it's possible, and we're working on that now. It is possible to get the social use of the funds without actual control, and if we can, then we will pursue that approach. If we can't, then we will fight to get control, and the control meaning that we would share equally with management, with a public chairman, on the structure of the board of trustees that would regulate the use of our pension funds. Gentleman here, then this gentleman.
Do you consider these the sales slump and cutback in production temporary, or are we in a new situation here?
I think that the American economy itself is going through a period of kind of adjustment. There are a lot of unknown economic factors, and I think that the automobile industry, because it is the most sensitive industry to any shift in the general economic climate, tends to over-reflect this situation. And I believe that it's essentially temporary in character and will correct itself. Well, in our testimony, we pointed out that there have been occasions where the industry tried to move the assembly of its cars faster than the kind of adequate inspection would be possible, and that this, in some isolated situations, could have been a factor, although I do not believe it's a factor in general. Gentleman here.
Do you think the increase in Ford sales, whereas Chrysler and GM brought up?
Well, it's hard to know precisely how the market behaves. It's a very erratic kind of process by which people buy automobiles. And you have a situation where one line moves faster. If someone had the answer to your question, they would be the most valuable person in the whole automobile industry, because the Edsel is a good example of why people don't know the answers to these questions in advance.
I didn't express it correctly. Is there any relation to the safety factor?
I think none whatever.
Mr. Ruther?
This gentleman here, then we'll come over here. Oh, I'm sorry. This gentleman here.
Mr. Ruther, the chairman of Republic Steel has said there's little chance of any improvement on the market without, in his opinion, a boost in product prices. How do you feel about that product?
Are you talking about automobiles, or?
He mentioned all along the market.
Well, I believe, and my testimony before the Congress indicated very clearly, that we believe the automobile industry can build a safer automobile without increasing the price of its cars. We have been urging a cut in the price of cars because the profit margin in the automotive industry has been excessive, and we believe the industry ought to share some of the fruits of our increasing productivity of our technology with the consumers through a lower price, and to use the building of a safer car as the basis for increasing the price of cars, I think would be wholly unjustified.
Would you then stick to federal wage and price laws or recommendations?
Well, we have not. We are opposed to the government regulating either prices or wages. We have suggested the establishment of a public wage price review board, where the key industries and the key unions dealing with those key industries would be required to defend the economics behind their wage claims or their price policy. And we believe that if the basic industries had to justify a price increase before the bar of public opinion, that we could mobilize the pressures and the leverages of enlightened public opinion and therefore discipline the private economic decision-making process and make it more publicly responsible. So we are opposed to the government setting wages or prices, but we are in favor of the big unions and the big corporations who determine the general movement of prices to be obligated to appear before a public price wage review board to defend the economics of their respective positions.
What legislation is the UAW the most concerned with right now?
Well, we are concerned about many kinds of things. We are concerned about civil rights. We are concerned about the poverty program. We believe that this country cannot live with itself and continue to tolerate a situation in which 30 million Americans really are the have-not peoples of America. We've got to deal with that. We've got to expand our efforts in the field of education. We are shortchanging our children and our young people. We've got to do more to rebuild our cities and to make them really decent, wholesome places for free men and women to live and raise their families. We've got the medical care programs, the broad question of health care, not just Medicare. We need to do all of these things, and this is the great challenge. Here we are. For the first time, we've got the tools of economic abundance. We've got the technology. We've got the know-how. We've got the skill. We've got the material resources to solve these problems. And the real question is, does America have a sense of purpose and a sense of discipline to begin to allocate its resources to deal with these basic unmet problems in our free society? And so we are in favor of doing all of these things, because all of these things are essential part of the building of the great society which the president is talking about. Gentlemen here, then we'll come over here.
Mr. Ruther, you haven't mentioned that besides ticketing R14B in your list of legislative priorities. What is it?
Well, we are in favor of the repeal of 14B for all the reasons that you know, because we think it's a discriminatory piece of legislation, and we believe that in an area where the federal government has preempted the field, that the state should not be permitted to, in effect, cancel out that federal preemption. On situs picketing, we support the efforts of the building trades to get relief there because we think that that is proper. But I'm discussing these broad social questions, that these are the things that the labor movement is committed to do, because only as we move ahead in the broad area in terms of education and civil rights and the poverty fight and housing and medical care will we be able to do the kind of things that are essential to build the kind of society that the labor movement is committed to build. Back here, this gentleman, then we'll come here.
The reports from Washington indicate that there was a labor boycott of the political dinner last night, which the president spoke, and I think the implication was that it had to do with recent legislative failures in Washington and so on. Could you comment on whether there was a known to you a labor boycott of the dinner?
I do not know whether there was a deliberate labor boycott. The UAW was represented there. And the only reason that I was not there personally is that I was in this city and could not be there. I think that there are some misunderstandings between the labor movement and the administration, and I would hope that those misunderstandings could be worked out, because I believe that if we are to move the Great Society legislative program forward, and if we are to do the other things that must be done in America, then I think we need a close, cooperative, working relationship between the American labor movement and the administration. And then we'll come back here.
Mr. Ruther, what about labor's attitude towards this country's foreign policy, vis-a-vis Vietnam?
Yeah, I think that the attitude of the American labor movement is pretty much a reflection of the cross-section of the attitude of the American people. You find all kinds of points of view in the American labor movement. And I think, in general, the policy of the AFL-CIO is a reflection of the position of the American people generally. This gentleman here.
Mr. Ruther, since wage parity is one of number one goals in the forthcoming negotiations, how could you apply that to the theater industry when you don't have the same situation as you do in the auto producer industry?
You mean the parts industry?
Parts industry.
Yes. Well, we have made it very clear. Now, we will not formulate our basic collective bargaining demands, which we will process in 1967. They will not be formulated at this convention. We will be calling, in the spring of 1967, a special collective bargaining conference where we will deal exclusively with the collective bargaining program of 1967. But this convention will, I believe, and I certainly will strongly recommend, that it will serve notice upon the industry that there are two things that we intend to do, among other things, in 1967. And one is that we are going to eliminate the wage differential between workers in the United States and workers in Canada. And we are going to bring our Canadian membership up to parity, because we take the position that a worker doing the same job, making the same automobile for the same company, that's now being sold in the same market, is entitled to get, and we are going to insist upon this in 67, the same wage. The other thing that we are dead serious about, and we are not just making brave noises about this, is we are determined in 1967, in our basic automotive negotiations that come up there, to abolish the obsolete and the economically unsound and morally indefensible system of paying workers by the hour. We are going to abolish the hourly rate system in 1967. And there can be no question in anybody's mind about that, that this is what we intend to do. Now, the parts industry presents a special problem. We are going to have to nurse that problem and work at it. And I think that while it is more difficult to deal with in terms of the U.S.-Canadian automobile agreement, I do believe that we can get a hold of this and we can make what I would consider to be meaningful progress in that area. although we do not minimize for one moment the complexity of that question.
Mr. Ruth, elaborate on the fact that you're going to make eliminate the hourly rate as a top priority in 67. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, we have been, as you know, working towards a system in which the worker would have an annual wage. We raised this many years ago. It came to the bargaining table as an active demand in 1955, and we came out of the Ford negotiations with the SUB, the Supplementary Unemployment Benefits Plan, which was their counterproposal to our guaranteed annual wage demand. We took that as the first historic step towards the concept that you pay a worker only when you need him, and when you don't need him, you dump him on the street and forget about him, and his response. That feeding him and his kids is somebody else's responsibility. So that the SUB in 55 was the first historic step. Then we took the SUB and we improved the benefits, we extended the period, we raised the amount of money available, and then we built into it the short work week concept, which was a very serious problem. It comes up now in the GM and Ford and Chrysler cutbacks, where a fellow works 3 days. Well, he's neither employed nor is he unemployed. He's already earned enough so he's disqualified for unemployment insurance. Well, he will get, in this situation, something approximating 90% of his weekly wage because he gets the SUB short work week benefit. Now, with the progress that we have made in this area, we are now, we believe, within what we would call manageable distance for making the final step towards the full and complete abolition of the hourly rate system. And we believe if General Motors can pay its top executives by the year, it can pay its production workers by the year. And we intend to make that a condition of the signing of an agreement in 1967. Now, I hold that to be true to all wage earners, but we have to start where we can only make a beginning. And I think that the automobile industry is a very logical place to make that beginning.
Mr. Ruther, how will this affect overtime rates and incentive wages? How will those workers react to
this? Well, first of all, the number of workers on incentive system in the automobile industry is rather microscopic. Because in the early days of our struggles, General Motors had a very large percentage on incentive, and we abolished those, and Ford never was on incentive, and so that the number of people on incentives is very, very small relative to the full workforce.
Mr. Ruther,
this gentleman over here.
How about that overtime?
When you're talking about guaranteed annual wage, are you talking about pay for 52 weeks out of the year?
Well, we have not worked out the details, and I am not prepared to get into a discussion of the details, but basically we intend to eliminate the hourly rate system, and this means moving to a salary. Now, how we will phase that, this is a matter that we have not worked out the details, but we will do that in advance of our collective bargaining, and at that time we will be able to discuss more fully the various details. Now, on the overtime thing, so it doesn't look as though I'm trying to run away with that from it, because I'm not, it seems to me that this is a problem that we also will be able to deal with, and obviously if a worker works overtime, then he would get some consideration of greater compensation for that, for those additional hours. This can be worked out. There are salary systems where that is built into the salary system now. Now we'll come over here and we'll deal with the left wing of this press conference. Mr. Herling.
I was worried about your left wing.
I appreciate your concern, Jack.
Now, Mr. Ruther, you referred a little bit earlier to the importance of the labor movement's aggressive thrust into social development. Do you think that the labor movement today is beyond the talking stage in this area? That's been said for a long time. Now, is there anything in the labor movement that gives you confidence that this thing can be done where it hasn't been done before?
Well, as I think everybody who knows my personal feeling, I'm always unhappy about what the labor movement is doing. I'm always dissatisfied. I'm always feeling that it must do more in the civil rights front, in the anti-poverty fight, in the housing field, in the medical field, in the field of education. But I do believe that we are moving. We aren't moving as fast as I would want the labor movement to move. I think that the very fact that the initiative in the anti-poverty crusade came from the labor movement. We had a civil rights leadership conference the other day, and the labor movement was actively involved in the discussion there of what we could do to mobilize for the civil rights legislation, which is now pending in the Congress. So that I believe the labor movement more and more has to move in this direction of becoming essentially a social movement, although it will never move fast enough to make me happy. And I presume that one of the roles that I ought to play in the labor movement is to keep pushing, and I intend to do that.
But that's a statement of your intention. What I'm concerned with in my question is whether or not there's anything in the labor movement that makes you feel that your intentions are about to be implemented, and concretely how.
Well, I think that that the key to that question is the fact that I believe that people like I.W. Abel, who comes into the leadership of the Steelworkers Union, and people like that who will be taking over the leadership of other unions in the period ahead, this is what gives me hope about the future of the American labor movement. I do not for one moment try to minimize the difficulties of trying to get a labor movement which historically has been oriented towards a much more limited concept of the role of labor in a free society, and the inertia and the indifference that that tends to develop on the part of older leadership. But I do believe that the labor movement will move more and more in the direction that I believe it must if it is to play the kind of decisive role on the American scene.
Walter?
I'm going to stay over here for a minute to be certain that I haven't missed anybody else.
Mr. Ruther, do you feel that we are actually experiencing a state of inflation right now? And if so, would you have any solutions?
Well, obviously, we are experiencing a measure of inflation. The very fact that the cost of living went up 2.8 during 1965, I think, is an economic fact that you can't ignore. I think, however, that what we've got are the kind of inflationary pressures that are highly spotty. It's not a general situation, and therefore we need to devise a highly selective approach as to how we deal with this spotty problem. An overall approach, I think, would be improper and inappropriate, and I think would not give us the kind of results we need. Now, the most single important factor with respect to the inflationary pressures is the excessive amount of capital which is being poured into capital expansion. That has increased now roughly 15% per year for the last 3 years, and has approached an annual investment of $61 billion. And this is the single most important factor in feeding the forces that make for inflation. And of course, that is possible because of the excessive earnings of American industry, because it's the excessive earnings where these huge sums of money that are used for capital expansion come from.
Would the elimination of the 7% tax credit help this materially, Walter?
I think it would have some impact upon the situation, although I do not think it would be as great as perhaps some people who advocate a repeal of the 7% would think. Take the General Motors Corporation as an example. The General Motors Corporation, and this is true of the automobile industry generally, have financed almost all of their capital expansion and been tremendous out of current earnings. And they've been able to set aside enough of current earnings. Now, if you repeal the 7%, this would not in any way have an appreciable impact upon General Motors. Although I would favor setting that aside, but I do not think that that in itself is adequate to deal with this excessive amount of money that is now going into the expansion of capital goods.
What about the war in Vietnam inflation? How do you feel about that question?
Well, obviously, if we step up the expenditures of money and the purchase of equipment and goods for Vietnam, that means that that is taxing the economy. But that in itself would not create a serious inflationary problem. But if you take that and you put onto it this excessive expansion of capital goods, then I think you begin to get yourself in some difficulty. But it ought to be dealt with on a selective basis rather than a general basis.
Sir, do you feel that the auto trade pact is working equitably for both the U.S. and Canadian members?
I think it's too early to evaluate the real impact of its operation upon either the United States or Canada. I believe that the consumers in Canada are still being shortchanged. They are not getting the kind of price reductions that this ought to give them because of the economies which the corporations are enjoying. I hope that the denial to the Canadian consumers is only a temporary thing, and we intend to keep making noises about this until the Canadian consumers get the kind of price reductions that they are entitled to out of the U.S.-Canadian agreements. This gentleman over here.
Mr. Ruther, you've mentioned now the annual salary, which I assume would be an increase on the present wages. You've also mentioned the Canadian, bringing Canadian workers up to parity. Which, you know, how can you justify both? And which will come first?
Well, it isn't difficult to justify both, and neither one has to come first because they're both coming together. And it's possible out of the fact that we have an industry in which the tools of production are fantastic and we are happy about those tools. We want the best tools that science and technology can give us. And when you look at the increase in productivity that makes possible these fantastic profits of $4 billion in 1 year, General Motors earned in 65, all we say is that if we get our equity, there is enough there so that the workers can have an annual salary and the Canadian workers can have wage parity and the American consumers can have a price cut in the price of their cars because of the productivity. When you look at the fact that if you take 1947, which was the first normal post-war automotive production year, we made in 1947 roughly 4.7 million cars and trucks. In 1965, we made over 11 million, with only a 6% increase in the workforce. So that the increase in production was from 4.7 to 11 million, with only 41,000 more workers. Now that's where we intend to get our annual salary and parity for Canadian workers with U.S. workers. And you can get the consumers with a lower price at the same time. This is the magic. This is the magic of the 20th century technological revolution.
How much is all this going to cost?
That we don't know. All I know is that it can be met out of the increase in productivity, and the UAW for many years, and we intend to continue the policy, we never want one penny in higher wages or improved fringe benefits that will require a price increase. This happens to be a union which historically has fought for a reduction in prices in advance of going to the bargaining table. We intend to continue that policy. This gentleman here.
You mentioned productivity. Are the current guidelines applicable to the auto industry, or are they too low?
Well, when you talk about the current guidelines, you're talking about a very broad economic concept that Walter Heller developed, and the people, unfortunately, only talk about one little part of a broad concept. Those guidelines also said that in an industry where the increase in labor productivity is low, that wages could be increased there even though it required a price increase, because in industries such as the automobile industry, where the productivity increase was excessively high, those industries would cut prices. This is what we urge the companies to do. But when they refuse, we are not going to sit on the sideline and say, well, because they aren't willing to live according to this concept, that they'll get all the gravy that flows from the increase in productivity. we're going to get part of our share of that also.
Do you feel that we're headed for a war with China?
Well, I really don't feel that that's the most important issue coming before our convention, but I don't think we are. I don't think we are because I believe, and I believe this very sincerely, I think that the President of the United States is showing great restraint in the face of great pressures, because there is much more pressure in America on the part of the hawks than there are on the part of the doves. And that the President is showing great restraint, and as long as he continues to do that, and I think he will, I think we can avoid the kind of escalation of the war in Vietnam, which I think would be tragic, and therefore I think we can avoid getting into a war with China. He has been invited. We have had the privilege of having a president the last two conventions. President Kennedy was with us 4 years ago. President Johnson was with us 2 years ago. He has been invited. We are still hopeful that he will come. But whether he's coming or not is a decision that he will make, and they will announce it from the White House.
Mr. Ruther, do you see the day when labor would really be united, and you might have the Teamsters and possibly the ILWU and AFL-CIO?
Yes, I think the day will come when the problems that currently divide these unions from the American labor movement can be resolved so that we can really unite the American labor movement. I don't know how soon that will happen. It is involved, and I don't want to discuss this in detail, but it's involved not only in matters of principle, but also in matters of personalities.
Mr. Ruther, you've been talking about excessive profits in Detroit. Would it then be fair to say that you feel that they're more interested in excessive profits than they are in safety?
Oh, I think that you don't have to do any basic research on the fact that the General Motors Corporation was not really organized to make automobiles. It was organized to make profits. That's their main product. And all of the other things are secondary. I believe, however, that the industry, I don't believe the industry deliberately makes unsafe cars. I think that anyone who thinks that is wrong. I think that the industry has been too overly concerned with jazzing up their designs and has not given the safety factor the kind of attention that I think it requires. And I'm hopeful that out of these hearings there will come on the part of the industry a greater sense of responsibility. And this is why we urge the establishment of federal standards to discipline into that responsibility.